I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Alyssa Smith has just published her debut novel, Speakeasy. It's set in the Pacific Northwest, and its genesis is from when Alyssa was looking at old Vancouver newspapers from the Great Depression, and she'd come across stories about Bill Bagley, a notorious bank robber. There wasn't much information on Bagley or his clockwork gang, and that's where Speakeasy takes off. We follow Lena Stillman, who joins the gang. We see their exploits and then follow her a decade later during World War II, where she tries to put her criminal past behind her. At this point, she's an elite codebreaker intercepting Japanese radio transmissions. I'll get Ms. Smith, who joins me now, to tell us about her book, all these fascinating characters, this remarkable time, and this place that she depicts. I've started the book, and it's just so enjoyable. Alyssa Smith is an award-winning journalist and author. The 100-Mile Diet, A Year of Local Eating, was published in 2009 and won numerous awards. I had her co-author, J.B. McKinnon, on at the time, and the book spawned a phenomenon across the continent and elsewhere. She has contributed to numerous publications, including Canadian Geographic, Explorer, and the National Post. She has received several national magazine awards. She is working on a sequel to Doublespeak already. Like a lot of people, I can't wait. This new book is published by Douglas and McIntyre. Incidentally, she'll be a part of an Insight event the 10th of May. That's the free event that the Vancouver Writers' Fest puts on downtown at the Vancouver Public Library. Visit writersfest.bc.ca for more information. Please welcome to the Planta Online program, Alyssa Smith. Ms. Smith, good morning.
Good morning, Joseph.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Bill Bagley, is that how you pronounce his name?
That's right.
Yeah. But how did you come across him?
I was doing historical research for another nonfiction project I was working on, and I was looking at headlines from the Vancouver Sun in the 1920s, and I kept seeing Bill Bagley and this robbery and running from the police and in jail, out of jail, sort of day after day for, you know, at least 5 years. He had done the biggest robbery in D.C. history up to that point when he stole the Dunsmuir Mine payroll in Nanaimo, and he got quite famous for that.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of almost treated as a swashbuckling kind of figure in the news at first when he was kind of at the top of his game. So I found that kind of fun. And his gang was called the Clockwork Gang because they timed everything down to the second, very professional at what they did. They'd come up from the States and kind of took the West Coast by storm.
Yeah. And so it's one thing to encounter a name regularly in the press, but to sort of have him as a central figure in a novel, because I've read elsewhere you say that you didn't really know much about him, and so writing this novel was sort of to fill in the blanks, if you will. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. In terms of the specific robberies, there were a lot of details, some of them perhaps more fanciful than true. The media back then was inclined to fill in their own blanks, but I was quite captivated by the witness testimony in the Nanaimo bank robbery, for instance. They had they almost presented him as sort of a polite or regretful figure because a woman became hysterical during the robbery. She had a baby, and she started to scream, "Shoot me, but don't shoot my baby." And Bill Bagley is reported to have said, "Is it a girl or a boy?" And she said it was a girl. And he's like, "You're lucky. If it was a boy, he might grow up to be like me one day." So just stuff like that really stuck with me. So I kind of could develop the character in my mind based on those kinds of fragments. But nothing was actually known about his background or upbringing or, of course, his actual thoughts or motivations for all these robberies.
So when we first encounter him in the book, we learn that he's going to be hanged for various crimes. I guess the book takes place in two eras, right? In the
mm-hmm.
Depression,
mm-hmm.
and then we come back again during the Second World War. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. And for me, part of filling in the blanks was wondering how he went from being the most successful BC robber in history, dealing this payroll, which was worth probably about $500,000 in today's money, till the end of his career when he tried to steal only about $250 from a hotel in Harrison Hot Springs and failed at that, but then was still on the lam for a few weeks from the police before he got caught down in Washington State.
Yeah.
So how did he go from this high to this low? But before I could write the story, I knew I needed his female counterpart, because one of the headlines when they were looking for him was "Follow the Woman." And I thought to myself, who is this woman? Who would be drawn to a person like this, who is strong enough to be with someone like this? And it was when I actually discovered my great aunt might have been a code breaker in World War II that it somehow clicked in my head that that was the kind of female character who craves adventure and secrecy and being part of an elite group that could be a match for Bill Bagley.
So Lena Stillman comes into the story, and so she gets hooked up with Bagley and the Clockwork Gang. What's she like, and what draws her into this lifestyle, if you will? Because we meet her later during the Second World War. You've alluded to this already. She is a code breaker during the Second World War. So I mean, there is a change in her lifestyle, if you will.
Yeah, she is sort of a victim of circumstance of the Depression. She starts out with a couple of years of university education in linguistics, but then her father loses his job, so she can't continue her education and ends up working as a bank teller. And that's when she encounters Bill Bagley when she's only 20 years old. So she's very impressionable, feeling kind of trapped in her circumstances and that life isn't fair. And why is her life ruined because her family lost all their money in the Depression? And then all of a sudden there's this swashbuckling bank robber coming in and living this life of adventure, and just sort of in a whimsical moment, she decides that's what she wants to be part of.
One of the things that your book reminds us of as we're reading it is just what a gritty, dark time it is, because we tend to think of Vancouver as sort of a sleepy port town, but I mean, it is a port town, and so that attracts sort of, you know, the unsavory elements of criminal life. This town especially, in this part of the world, I mean, it wasn't altogether pleasant, was it? And I mean, we have to remember, too, that it was the Depression, right?
Yeah, exactly. And the headlines are surprisingly violent, much more violent, I would say, even than today, the kinds of crimes on the street, shootings and things like this.
Yeah.
It had a very Wild West feel out here. And I think part of the reason he was treated with not exactly sympathy in the media, but kind of like some kind of daring anti-hero, I guess, while he was successful, was there was a sense from the 20s that there were some people that had too much and not everyone had shared in that, and then all of a sudden it's the Depression and almost no one has anything anymore, but there's still a few wealthy people who are left untouched by this disaster, and that there's a sense of unfairness among people. So I think there's kind of a secret sympathy for these bank robbers at that time.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, people want distraction from whatever they're going through, and there's no television, and radio, I guess, is just coming to its infancy, and I guess people did read newspapers every day. I mean, the papers that you went through, I mean, they would publish multiple editions during the day, right?
That's right, and there were a number of other newspapers in Vancouver at that time besides the Sun and Province. It was a very thriving media at that time. It was probably its heyday, really, So people followed these stories like they would now an HBO series or something. This was their entertainment.
Yeah. Your portrayal of Vancouver is such a delight to read because, you know, I'm a bit of a nostalgia buff, and I like seeing this town that I've lived in for my whole life and see what it was like. And so there's a marvelous line in the book about, you talk about how Vancouver is at the time, and this is the 1920s. The cities in America are developing and are large and are big, and Vancouver is, you know, not different in terms of its ambition. You write that, of course, people failed to realize that America was so far ahead of them, but their optimism was bracing. I mean, so it's a marvelous insight into what people in this town at that time, what they were going through and how they were viewing themselves in the larger context.
Yeah, it was fascinating for me because I absolutely love BC history. So looking at all the old photographs and looking at the few old buildings downtown that remain and kind of stripping away all the skyscrapers in my mind and what was left, you know, the little core of the city near, like, say, Granville and Hastings or Gastown. And, yeah, that sense of a very far western, remote city where anything was possible was very exciting. And then I also did try to imagine what would it look like to the eyes of an outsider, someone who is used to more sophisticated cities like San Francisco or Seattle that were, you know, at least 50, if not 200 years older in the case of San Francisco in terms of European buildings.
Yeah.
and how different and sort of small scale Vancouver would look to them. But just, yeah, that sense of optimism was definitely there.
Yeah, and that's why you get the sort of criminal element, the ambitious element in society. You know, that's what drags Lena into this lifestyle with Bagley, right?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. It's an ambition for all classes of people could play out here. And she saw that and wanted to be a part of it. That's what I wanted to write, a woman who was very ambitious in that period, which was rare, but there were in real life quite a number of women code breakers in the military in World War II, ones who had studied mathematics and languages, because, of course, so many Canadian men were off fighting. They were the backup plan, and then they were allowed to prove themselves and come into their own.
So a lot of us in recent years have learned of Bletchley Park and Alan Turing. There were code breakers like them on this coast, is that right? And I mean, I sort of wonder why. I mean, did people think at the time that the war could come here?
It was more just the proximity to the Pacific Ocean, the signals coming from the Japanese ships, the radio signals. Mm. So there were stations at Point Grey and in Victoria and on the far west coast of Vancouver Island because they had the best access to the signals. So for that reason, they became quite important to the war effort and communicated a lot with both the Americans in the Pacific Defense, Coast Defense, and with the British. There was a lot of going back and forth to be trained by the British to have the latest up-to-date techniques in code breaking, and also access. They captured the machines that made the codes so that you could learn, the people here could learn how the machines worked, and it was a lot easier to decode things then.
So you mentioned you have this great aunt who was a code breaker. I mean, how much of what her work was during the war do you know about?
Very little, because she only started to talk about it in her older years. So it's more of a family lore at this point. I was just talking to her daughter about it recently, and she hadn't heard much about it, but she had told me about it and told my mom about it. So for me, it was more just a triggering event when she told me about it first, that was what inspired me to create that character. So now I'm also thinking, oh, it would be interesting to research exactly what she did, because she treats it with a lot of secrecy, because it was top secret for 50 years. And even now, for any of the Canadians who served in the military, all their military records are still closed. You have to specifically get access requests approved, or freedom of information requests, that type of thing. So it's all quite secretive still, really.
Yeah. So she never gave you a sense of the sort of messages that they were intercepting at the time, right?
No, not at all. I more just did research into what was going on at the base in Esquimalt and Vancouver, and also all of the Commonwealth nations and their participation in the code breaking. Because there's some quite interesting biographies out there written, say, by the Australians or the British, and the Canadians worked quite closely with them.
Yeah.
So I was more inspired by that in terms of the details that are in the book.
So loyalty is a theme that you talk about throughout the book, and I guess how does Lena view that in light of where she is during the Second World War and where she was during, say, the Depression, this past criminal life of hers?
Yeah, loyalty was kind of the founding value for Bill Bagley. So even though he was a criminal in so many ways, he had his own code of honor, and to him, Lena broke that by leaving him, but she had very good reasons to do it. So she obviously didn't view their time together and her departure from the gang as a betrayal, but Bill did. But then it's sort of that sense in life that I think I've started to realize, you know, you feel like sometimes you do things in your life over and over again the same way without realizing that's what you're doing, until you're right trapped in the middle of it. And you're like, oh, wait a minute, I made this choice before. It just looks different this time. How did this happen? So that's kind of what happens to Lena when she gets wrapped up in betrayal of her new love interest and the secret between them, which I won't detail too much for fear of spoiling the plot of the book.
Right. So the other thing that I read about you in recent years is that you work as a fraud examiner.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I kind of have a diverging career path. I got interested in white-collar crime and fraud when I sat on the board of an arts charity, and encountered fraud, and I thought to myself, what kind of people would defraud a charity? And I got very interested in the criminal psychology and the actual, just how the numbers work. How would you uncover financial crimes? So I decided to become a forensic accountant mm-hmm. so I could use my investigative skills from journalism in a different way and hopefully make white-collar criminals accountable for what they do.
So
I'm just kind of getting going on that. It's been a very long process, but I'm very excited about that.
Yeah, does that part of your life and the evolution of your life, say, does that inform writing fiction for you? Because this is the first novel, right?
Yeah, just more in the sense of having learned a lot more about what is the psychology behind the white-collar criminal, which is, in fact, seeking out the most vulnerable people or groups because they're the easiest to defraud. So that's a bit different maybe from your kind of guns and getaway bank robber type. But,
yeah.
I mean, he's looking for the most vulnerable, you know, banks. What's going to be the easiest one to break into? But in some ways I see it as kind of a more straightforward kind of a crime. Still a crime, but perhaps less devious than white-collar crime. And so often white-collar criminals get away. I mean, someone could steal $500 from a corner store and the police would go after them, but someone could alter the financial statements of a large corporation by $500,000, and some people inside may even know about it, but they think, oh, he's one of us, he's okay, and never phone the police, and they may never get caught.
Yeah. So in the course of writing this book and now the work you do in examining fraud, I mean, do you have any insight as to what motivates people and why people do the things that they do, especially the bad things?
Usually it starts small. People, and often they're pressured by life circumstance. Perhaps they're going through a messy divorce. Maybe they've become a drug addict or a gambling addict and they desperately need money. So it's often a change in life circumstance, a sense of desperation, and they start small usually, but then if it works, they're like, oh, it worked, and it just keeps expanding from there. They try a bigger amount of money the next time. Apparently the average white-collar fraud lasts about 2 years before detection, so I suppose people should quit at a year and a half if they want to not get caught.
When you flesh out a character like Bill Bagley and because he is a bad guy in terms of you know, robbing people and banks, do you have a sense of where that comes from? I mean, you mentioned that life circumstances may inspire theft, but I sort of wonder. I mean, are bad people, are they born bad? Say.
I mean, I guess my take would be no, but more either likely born in bad circumstances or raised in a somewhat immoral environment for the nurture side of it, if you will. I mean, in terms of Bill Bagley, as I said, I only had those few snippets that maybe gave me a sense that he had a rough life that he was regretful of, and this maybe wasn't necessarily the path he would have chosen, except that he felt he had no other choice. So that gave me the sort of first chink of sympathy for him that I think you need to write any fictional character, because really if you read most of the headlines, they're just like, and then he shot a cop and this and that. I would doubt he would be a very likable person if you'd met him in real life, but it's hard to say.
Yeah.
I mean, he obviously was charismatic because he was always gathering people around him and inspiring them to do these crazy robberies that he dreamed up. But by the process of writing fiction, you have to understand people's motivation to a degree that makes you sympathetic to them, I think. So even though overall I think he's quite a bad person, I still found the very human elements in him, and probably most criminals have that.
Well, what's it like to create a character like Lena? I mean, she is someone that you like, right?
Yeah, for her it was almost the opposite, because when I started out, I was thinking, okay, I want a strong female character, but in a time when it was hard to be a strong woman, it was still hard for women to get ahead professionally. Very capable, intelligent, educated. But once I had that kind of a list, I thought to myself, well, I can't make her perfect because that's not real. So I had to think to myself, what are her flaws? What's wrong with her? So for her, you know, she's too arrogant, too, in McLean to believe her ideas are right and not take other people's feelings or situations into account. She's quite blind to the sufferings of Byron, who loved her silently for years because it's not of interest to her, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I tried to create, for her, it's more the opposite. Bill started out looking pretty bad on paper, and I had to think what's good about him. Lena started out, there's lots of great things about her, but no one's 100% great, so what's bad about her? So I still admired her very much, but I tried to think of how Jane Austen, when she wrote the character Emma for that book, she thought to herself, I will create a character that no one but myself shall like. But then she turned out to be absolutely loved by everyone because she was a strong, educated woman who wasn't afraid to have her own opinion and make her own choices, which I think is appealing to people.
So the Speakeasy is out now, and I understand that you're working on a follow-up, if you will, Double Speak, is that right?
Yes, that's right. I hadn't actually originally intended a sequel when I wrote it, but when the New York publisher, St. Martin's, read it, they asked me to write a sequel, and I realized when I had written the end, at the end of Speakeasy, I could imagine Alina carrying on with her life elsewhere, with further sort of code-breaking adventures and whatnot, so it seemed like a natural fit, and it was really fun to start revisiting those characters, so I was glad that my publisher had that idea.
So I've been reading you for years. I mean, I had James on when the 100 Mile Diet came out, I've read you in magazines and your journalism over the years. Was writing fiction something that you thought you wanted to do? Say, was it in the back of your head, or...?
Yeah, it had been in the back of my head for many years, and I'd sort of worked on other manuscripts in the background, but then I decided this was really for writing where my interest was, more so than the journalism, so I just committed whole hog, and I actually did the School for Writers program through Humber and had a really terrific mentor, Richard Bausch, an American novelist, so I found that very useful in terms of getting the feedback and developing my work and feeling like it was ready to be out there, because fiction is very challenging, I find, at least coming from a nonfiction background, because the choices in fiction are infinite. So if someone doesn't like your character or your plot line, they're like, well, just change it. But then you have to think to yourself, how, you know, what next? So it's quite overwhelming. So it's nice to have kind of a mentor in that process.
Yeah, it seems... it might sound patronizing as I say this, but reading your novel, that you'd been at it for a long time, it doesn't seem like a debut novel, if you will.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I mean, I guess it is because I spent, you know, I have another manuscript that's just sitting in a drawer that's never been published. This, I think, is considerably better, and because of the experience I had in the first one, thank you, that's very nice to say. It doesn't sound like a debut novel, so I hope all the work that I put in then it paid off.
Yeah, because I read people who write nonfiction and then go into fiction, and you can sort of see how it's sort of just like they're nonfiction but made up, if you will, right?
Right, yeah.
But this has such richness in it, and you know, people that I like, and even people that I don't really like, or scenarios that I don't really like. I mean, I'm compelled to, I mean, I started this book, but I'm compelled to finish it because I want to see how this all turns out.
Thanks. I mean, when I wrote it, definitely had that sense of, I had a lot of fun writing it. I kind of consider it a literary page turner, I guess. Maybe that's its own genre or something.
Yeah.
So, 'cause I wanted to give people the depth of emotions and thoughts and inner lives of a more serious novel, but I wanted a very fast paced plot that's a bit more like a heist novel or something like that people would have fun to read.
So do you still work as a journalist, as a writing in nonfiction, say?
No, with the novel, and then with the auditing and moving into fraud examining, I haven't had time for anything else. So no, I haven't, but I can definitely see when I have more experience as a forensic accountant, I could definitely see nonfiction coming out of that at some later time.
Yeah, it's such an enjoyable book, and congratulations on it. It's such a fine achievement. I appreciate your time today. I remember when I had James on recently, I told him that the one thing I remembered about the 100 Mile Diet was you. because you're really funny in that. You came across as funny in that book, and so it's been nice talking to you today.
Oh, thanks very much, Joseph. It's my pleasure.
The book is called Speakeasy. It's from Douglas and McIntyre. It's author Alyssa Smith joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.